just like to start by saying how lovely it is to be back here. I first read here 9 years ago. I looked up when I'd been here, and so it's wonderful to be back. I'm just going to do a very quick plug before I get into reading of competition flyers I've brought. They're on the table, and I've brought copies of my most recent collection, House of Small Absences. The late Dennis O'Driscoll said, any fool can write poetry, it takes a genius to sell it. So I always think I have to do a bit of a plug. So thank you, Bernadette, for that lovely introduction. I want to thank Paul Casey for making Cork part of this coastal voyage I'm on at the moment, and the Civic Trust for hosting this afternoon's workshop, and you'll hear from those people later. And to thank Arts Council England, who've helped with travel costs to allow me to visit so many coastal places, not just to workshop and read and talk about, but also to think about in my own time the poetry and literature of coasts and islands. I've also taken the workshops and performances and coastal exploring to Felixstowe in Suffolk, as far east as you can go in England before you hit Rotterdam, to Cornwall, which is as far in the opposite direction and just a little southeast of here, to North America's Atlantic seaboard, to Massachusetts and Maine, to Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island and Cape Breton Island in Canada, to Orkney and Forays and Ascent and Scotland's Western Isles, where you can imagine I found lots of Cape Breton and Nova Scotia connections with the same Gaelic language, almost the same as our own North Antrim Gaelic, and the same fiddle and pipe tunes, and the same family names, including lots of McNeils from the island of Barra, my mother's clan, and my own Scottish heritage. Just 3 months ago, I was in Lubeck in Maine, which is the most easterly point in the US and the point nearest to Ireland, just 2,500 miles from Cork, even though I travelled 15,000 miles in total on the American part of the trip. In fact, a poet I know who's been following my itinerary on Facebook, which has become my captain's logbook in a way, just messaged me to say he was amazed at the odyssey I was undertaking in 10 months when Odysseus's odyssey had taken 10 years. But naturally, when it came to starting out on this odyssey, on this voyage out, which is both the performance and workshop tour and the research for my next book, which will be published next spring by Seren Books in Wales, I started out from home. That's not from home where I live now in London, but from the home I grew up in, which was Cushendall in the Antrim Glens, where I was born in the third last house out on Limerick Point, with the sea on three sides of us, due directly south from the Isle of Mull and Portree on Skye, and from Stornoway on Lewis in the northernmost of the Western Isles. So I'd always wanted to explore that geography and Gaelic Scottish heritage that was always just visible in the mists on the horizon. But when I planned the American strand of the project, the voyage out, I also had to be sure of getting to Belfast, Maine, because my mother was born in Belfast, County Antrim, and because it was from Belfast, County Antrim, that my great aunt, Rose McNeil, whose grandfather was from Barra, embarked on her own voyage out at the age of 14 across the Atlantic in 1911, like so many other McNeils and so many other Irish migrants, to Canada and on from there, in her case, to Binghamton in New York State. I finally made it to Belfast, Maine, which I was surprised to find had its own small-scale shipbuilding industry, and I also made it to Halifax in Nova Scotia, which is the final chapter of a tragic story, a tragic voyage that started out in my mother's native Belfast and had, for our family anyway, a significant Cork connection. Halifax, Nova Scotia is the port where so many of those who drowned in the sinking of the Titanic were brought ashore for burial, the Titanic being the main ship my Belfast grandfather had worked on in the Belfast shipyards. As a ship fitter, he was one of the maintenance team that accompanied the ship's designer, Bruce Ismay, on Titanic's sea trials to Liverpool and on her maiden voyage as far as Cork, where he was transferred on the mail boat at Cove and replaced by another fitter who'd come down by train from Belfast because he'd asked to go back to Belfast and marry Mary McNeil from Glenravel in the Antrim Glens. None of the rest of the team of craftsmen survived the voyage, so you can imagine With a shipbuilding grandfather and a falling in love that meant he managed to avoid one of history's major maritime tragedies, and with just living, as I was growing up, in a coastal community of fishermen and merchant seamen, the ocean's been in my sights for a very long time. And I realised at some point that my first 5 books of poetry were literally flooded, inundated with images of the ocean and ocean going. The run of the tides, mysterious voyages, lost mariners, shipwrecks, deserted headlands, and of course my own need to continually cross back over by ferry from Stranraer to Larne in County Antrim to get home to visit my folks. For years I've loved reading other writers who've explored the sea's power, and I've realised I've finally become one of those writers. This is The Voyage Out, which is a journey, a sequence of poem and thought and memory. How long have I been writing about the sea? Well, since I started writing, I guess, it's been a constant theme. The tidelines, the slip that way, and the people I grew up among on the Antrim coast whose livelihood was the ocean, both those who sailed deep sea and those who worked in local ferries, just like the many island ferries I've been on in the past few months, or worked as coast guards and lighthouse keepers, and those who worked in our local fishing industry. And my first poetry publication was, unsurprisingly, entitled A House by the Sea, followed by another with a maritime title, Late Crossing. That one had in it a poem called A Sea of Moyle, in which I asked myself, what brings me back here, year after year, to this place? And the answer, inevitably, in the poem is, I'd say it's the sea every time. Even in my latest, my 5th poetry collection last year, I still find myself coming back, still find myself writing about slipways and headlands and tides. And there's a series of small distilled recollections in that book, House of Small Absences, recollections of the coastal life I grew up with on the edge of that sea of Moyle. And those small, simple recollections are interwoven in the book with some of my less obvious ways of making sense of the past and of the world around us. So this is one of those little memory pieces from the book, a tiny snapshot of coastal life. Kingfisher days. They amount, spliced end to end, to a flickering of uninterrupted decades of heady shoreline days, late setting evenings and exams finished, frantic bee stings, the daily island boat, borrowed bikes to the next harbour town, with all the drenching, pervasive, saturate downpours literally obliterated. Well, I guess I don't ever expect to be free of the power of those memories, any more than I expect to lose the sense of excitement or the sense of threat that comes from growing up on the edge of something deep and unknowable. And maybe that's a big metaphor in my life. So I've decided to confront whatever it is that has us constantly looking out there to islands or far horizons and wondering. One of the writers I have to have with me in facing that horizon is someone I've always thought of as a US poet, a Boston poet, but whom I've come to think of more and more on my journey as a Nova Scotia poet, because she did much of her growing up in Nova Scotia, and that's Elizabeth Bishop. I've always adored her writing about coastlines and islands and maps, and although she lived in Brazil at a time, she spent her early years in her grandparents' home in a village simply called Great Village, which I'd always imagined would be very much like my home village, and like many of the coastal villages I've explored since, with its church and school and post office and volunteer fire brigade, and it's one filling station that Bishop famously wrote about. And I had the good fortune to spend some time back in May in Great Village, discovering just how alike our small coastal towns actually were, and sleeping in the house where Elizabeth Bishop spent those early years, right opposite the famous filling station. Bishop is especially inspiring for me because she understands what's so special about coasts and islands, both remoteness and solitude, and something of the excitement of the sea, of the need to take that voyage out. Of course, everyone quotes John Donne, who famously and rightly said, "No man is an island." But what Elizabeth Bishop really gets is that we should allow ourselves to be islands some of the time. Not to be isolated, although that has in it the Italian word isola for an island. Not to be insular in our thinking, but to be insulated from the noise and distraction of the busy world. Not so much to look for loneliness as to value aloneness. Listen to what she says. "There is a peculiar quality about being alone, an atmosphere that no sounds or persons can ever give. It is as if the mind finds its sea, the wide quiet plain with different lights in the sky and different, more secret sounds. But it appears that we are frightened by the first breaking of its waves at our feet, and now we will never go on voyages of discovery and never find the islands of the imagination. Being alone can be fun. Alone the mind can do what it wants to. But we can never understand this while we stand on the shore with our backs to the water and cry after our companions. Perhaps we shall never know the companion in ourselves who is with us all our lives. The nearness of our minds at all times to the rare person whose heart quickens when a bird climbs high and alone in the clear air." Perhaps I'm getting a message here. Perhaps Elizabeth Bishop is one major inspiration behind this journey. Perhaps she's an encouragement to rediscover that rare person in me, that other self, that companion she talks about deep inside, whose heart quickens at the sound of a kittiwake's cry, or the lilt of the sky boat song, or the rush of retreating waves on shingle. And I'm kind of in awe of Elizabeth Bishop as a travel writer anyway. She didn't simply travel in South America, but she also visited my hometown of Christiandol on a motoring tour of the Antrim coast in the 1930s. And I love to think of her stopping at my grandmother's own filling station and heading down Bridge Street and along Main Street, out past the school where I would learn the sky boat song, and past the church and courthouse and the 1930s cinema, out onto the Antrim Coast Road. But back to my earliest poetic roots. BBC Radio 3 recently asked me to make a programme about my poetry and to choose a major early influence. And I chose a New England poet, the 19th century Amherst poet, Emily Dickinson. Surprisingly, Emily and I have a great deal in common around small town life and church going and childhood, something anyone from Ireland or New England would recognise. And though she was very much an inland soul, and I've driven that long turnpike from Boston Harbor myself, way inland to Amherst, Massachusetts, where Emily lived, and it's very many miles inland. But even as an inland soul, Emily was fascinated by the concept of the sea as an exciting, challenging place. When she was 20, Emily wrote to a friend, "The shore is safer, but I love to buffet the sea. I love the danger." And for me, growing up with cold North Channel waters crashing on the shore just below our house, I was with her in that excitement that verged on both exuberance and dread. Until a couple of months ago, as I'm writing about lighthouses among other coastal themes, I decided, as we were in Rockland, Maine, to walk the mile-long granite breakwater out to Rockland Harbour Light. And I found out what it what it feels like to be buffeted by wind and waves and spray, with the sea 3 feet away on either side of the granite breakwater. But yes, I loved the danger. And here's what Emily, that inland soul, has to say about heading out to sea. Exultation is the going of an inland soul to sea, past the houses, past the headlands, into deep eternity. So, to return to the question of what it was like growing up on the edge of something vast and exciting, growing up on the edge of a sense of both calm and danger. Of course, that wildness was always there in the poetry that's been written about the Sea of Moyle and the Antrim coast. And it was made pretty clear to us in the Irish legends we grew up with that being sent to live by our Sea of Moyle was the cruelest punishment that a wicked stepmother could come up with in the Irish legends that's known as the Children of Lear. Although the punishment of turning the children into swans actually seems somehow beautifully poetic, almost balletic, in contrast to the cold and wild November waves crashing on the rocks just below our house. But it seems changing children into seabirds wasn't just a punishment in Irish mythology. And I've recently contributed a poem to a book called Metamorphic, edited by Nessa O'Mahony, a poet I'm sure many of you know. And it was published in March in the UK and in Australia, in which the character Scylla, from Greek mythology, that some of you might know, is changed into a bird as punishment and ends up wintering, well, in my version anyway, on that same Sea of Moyle with those swans who were really the banished children of Lear. But if there's an inevitable fascination with the sea itself and headlands and cliffs, there's also that magnetic attraction many of us coastal people feel for lighthouses. Those sentinels of another world, those guardians of the sea world, and a fascination for the lives of those who had to live in them. And there's an amazing history there to consider. By the end of this week, I'll have made my way coastwise to the Hook Lighthouse, second oldest lighthouse in the world, apparently, which has had a beacon there since the 5th century. And the last manned lighthouses here in Ireland were only finally automated in 1997, right at the end of the 20th century. That's an awful lot of years, a millennium and a half of solitary lives lived in isolation on cliff tops and rocky outcrops in the sea. I suppose I've always wondered about those lives, and in particular, what extreme isolation can do to you. One story we grew up with, one mystery, was that of Flannan Isle from a poem by Wilf Gibson about an abandoned lighthouse where everything looked normal, as if the keepers were just about to sit down for a meal, and had all those echoes of the Mary Celeste, a ship that appeared to be inexplicably abandoned. No explanation was forthcoming, except that the story seemed to represent what can happen to a bunch of ordinary men living in extraordinary circumstances. That poem, Flannan Isle, was published in 1912, and an offshore lighthouse is also the central obsession of a novel which appeared in 1927, which is Virginia Woolf's novel, To the Lighthouse. Woolf was rare as an early 20th century writer in exploring what we feel inside, in voicing interior turmoil, rather than the external drama of what we actually do or say in life. And To the Lighthouse is a classic example of that interior voice, in that it's a whole novel, not about the drama or mystery of a lighthouse, but about the mere attempt to get to the lighthouse, a whole novel about longing and disappointment. Woolf had spent her family holidays in Cornwall, and in reality the lighthouse the Woolf family always wanted to get to was Godrevy Lighthouse near St Ives, even though Woolf's fictional version is actually set on the Isle of Skye, which is, as I mentioned, due directly north of where I grew up in Antrim. So I'm going to read a short extract from the point in the story at which getting to the lighthouse rock, getting to visit the lighthouse itself, all still seems possible. In this scene we have Mr. Ramsay and his children, Camilla and James, on the much anticipated journey. And of course Camilla is the character who most closely resembles Virginia's own feelings at that age about her family and holidays and lighthouses and promises and anticipation. And I've always identified with the fact that the boatman taking them to the lighthouse is a local fisherman called McAllister, because a lot of the fishermen where I grew up, on our side of the Sea of Moyle, south of Virginia, Wolfskye, were families of McAllisters. Yes, the breeze was freshening, the boat was leaning, the water was sliced sharply and fell away in green cascades, in bubbles, in cataracts. Cam looked down into the foam, into the sea with all its treasure in it, and its speed hypnotized her. She began to think how fast it goes, where are we going? While James, with his eyes fixed on the sail and on the horizon, steered grimly. But he began to think as he steered that he might escape, he might be quit of it all. They might land somewhere and be free then. Both of them, looking at each other for a moment, had a sense of escape and exaltation. But the breeze bred in Mr. Ramsay too the same exaltation, and as old McAllister turned to fling his line overboard, he cried out aloud, "We perished, each alone." So Mr. Ramsay is actually Virginia Woolf's portrayal of her own father, and like a typical father, he's loving the challenge and the drama of being out at sea, and is quoting from a Victorian poem called The Castaway about, unsurprisingly, a shipwreck. I've always understood both his love of the ocean's drama and Virginia's sense of longing. In my case, the longed-for destination was always going to be the island closest to where I grew up, with three lighthouses in this case, and that was Rathlin Island, just north of Cushendall. People might have heard of Rathlin off the Antrim coast, not just because it's featured in poems and novels, but because Marconi did his first test there in 1898 before setting up at Crookhaven in County Cork, and finally succeeding with the first transatlantic phone conversation between President Roosevelt and Edward VII between his transatlantic stations in Cornwall and Wellfleet on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And because I'd grown up with that mystique of Rathlin and Marconi and radio waves, I actually went to the site of the old Marconi station at Wellfleet on Cape Cod on my coastal journey up through New England recently, just to look across the 2,500 miles from Marconi Beach to Rathlin. But it was a cold, wet, misty day that would have made the worst fairhead weather or mizzenhead weather seem positively mild. And to be honest, I couldn't see 30 feet in front of me. But maybe that's precisely why ships needed Marconi's wireless, and all the subsequent inventions like radar and mobile phones that came from his experiments on the Antrim coast and County Cork and Cape Cod. So Rathlin Island always seemed like it was just within reach. And once, when we were teenagers, four of us set out in a small boat that ended up with the same disappointment as Virginia Woolf's lighthouse trip. Rathlin Island is just off Fairhead, the most northerly point in the north of Ireland, and I guess we should have known that with three lighthouses, it has to be surrounded by a very complicated system of currents, and that weather systems and sea patterns can suddenly change their mind, that the legendary Sea of Moyle can suddenly change its mood, even on the mildest of summer days. So inevitably, the seas got rougher, and we found ourselves drifting in choppy waters, and we started to think we might all perish, each alone, as the dramatic Mr. Ramsay liked to imagine that they might all have done. I guess anyone can understand the relief of coming back into your own bay after a crisis like that. But then there's the puzzle of looking up at the headland and trying to see your own house, which always looks different from out at sea. Something I've written about in my book, The Ghost Twin, and something Virginia Woolf captures perfectly into The Lighthouse. So in this little extract, the family, the Ramsay family, are coming back into shore, and Camilla is trying to work out which is their house. "See the little house?" he said, pointing, wishing Cam to look. She raised herself reluctantly and looked, but which was it? She could no longer make out, there on the hillside, which was their house. All looked distant and peaceful and strange. The shore seemed refined, far away, unreal. Already the little distance they had sailed had put them far from it and given it the changed look, the composed look of something receding in which one has no longer any part. Which was their house? She could not see it. I did, however, get to Rathlin years later to give a weekend of creative writing workshops, but I got there in a proper island ferry. So the first thing you need on any voyage is to have a map of where you're going. I had a character in a poem once who had all the maps in the world and spent years poring over them, but never actually left the house. He just travelled in his imagination. So if there's one thing worse than having the maps and never making the journey, it's making the journey and not having the maps. I guess with GPS and Google Maps, you could get nearly anywhere now without actual maps. But it doesn't feel like a real expedition to me if I haven't got a folded map. So a few months ago, I headed off to Stanford's in London's Covent Garden, which is apparently the world's leading map store, and bought detailed maps of all the coasts I'm visiting. So I shall read the first piece of the new travel writing journey, which shifts between poetry and prose, as well as switching between actual travel writing, what I'm finding out now about coastal lives at each new place, and some pieces that merge thought and memory and poetic fragments. I'll kind of show you what it looks like on the page. It's got little bits on either side, but again, I think that will look different in the book. But it sort of works in segments, you know, switching sides and margins and format, the way thoughts and ideas, you know, switch back and forth. And when it's published, poems and thought and travel writing will be interleaved from page to page. These first few extracts I'll read are from the first chapter, and they play around with a childhood fascination for maps. The English novelist and travel writer Graham Greene said at the beginning of his novel, The End of the Affair, "If this book of mine fails to take a straight course, it is because I am lost in a strange region. I have no map." 1. An enchantment of maps. On the Hillman Hunter's crumpled passenger seat, on the side wall of St. Mary's Primary 7, or a Collins classroom globe, the flip-out gazetteer in the back fold of a diary embossed Fives Motors or Firestone, a threadbare by O-level Phillips Atlas, two travel bleached OS quarter-inch series, dark in a tall boy drawer, all promising entree to the well-thumbed, dog-eared reality beyond our Dalrymple Avenue, all mere two-dimensional intimations of illimitable possible worlds. Tinny, axis-rattling revolutions of a Christmas morning globe, I am 8, finger-tracing shivers of Alaska, Bolivia, Canberra, tracking latitudes, tropics off, peninsulas, Abyssinia and Dar es Salaam, outdoing the others with the plangent music of the Thousand and One Nights. 2. No readable map. End of each annual fortnight, and Northwest Donegal will have another yellowing, sellotaped rip on a fold that could matter one day between two towns and a lost river, thread separating from glued binding, from folding and refolding our compacted paper kingdoms back to front and inside out. The map stack in the Hillman's glove compartment. Glove compartment. When has that locked box ever seen motoring gauntlets, Fair Isle mittens, Sunday kid gloves? A trove that includes the gift of a Michelin, Espana, we have no plans to use, no language to access, an accreting, expandable treasure chest, verging on the unshuttable, a veritable chart room locker, reluctantly sharing its cramped map space with stray glacier mints, no bag, a Pope John the 23rd Sunday missal, a junior mole wrench, a blunt Revlon lipstick, cherries in the snow, a praying plastic Blessed Virgin of Lourdes water replenished after each Easter vigil. 3. Blood ties. My brothers vie for backseat possession of the mail order motorist compass, bicker over which way the spread out mat should lie across their bony knees. The needle bobs reckless on most of our routes, shudders helpless on the 7 mile straight's nauseating switchback. Index fingers trace ripple red veins, B roads and the unmarked. The unmarked, which roads would remain unmarked, which of us? We amanah over customs posts, ancient monuments, a bridge, an RC church, squabble over the complex business of these vital charts, over the exactitude of their longitudes, the exactings of longing, the abyss of a no maps land. So that would be all fine and practical as long as the maps remained in the glove compartment, except that they were always brought inside to plan the next day's trip and to pore over on rainy boarding house days and maybe even for other purposes. Four. And then the rains came. In the deluge of a port noon August fortnight, days of ennui pending a cessation, confined to a cliff house parlour at a picture window that could easily be high out on an Atlantic swell, full sound effects. We're told off for vandalism. Resourcefulness, surely, hadn't we been using our initiative? All those damn bars of cutting, folding, metamorphosing last year's AA guide back pages into a flotilla of paper sailboats, perfectly pleated, mine a Girona, Gerard's from his illustrated look and learns, would have to be the Duke of Medina Sidonia's flagship, foundering on the local rocks. Wet days and we're totally off scale. My father cites more and more unreachable destinations on no map whatsoever. Destinations we'll be setting out for any minute now. Definitely any minute now, just as soon as that rain lifts. The great voyage into the unknown, into the heart of Graham Greene's Africa, perhaps even to the interior, to Timbuktu, my father's ultimate wet day threat. The voyage we know we will never make. So that's all about exploring one part of my obsession with maps and travel. But we all know that maps aren't just about finding our way somewhere. They're also about finding buried treasure. And I discovered from reading about Elizabeth Bishop when I was staying in her childhood home in Nova Scotia a couple of months ago, that she'd once buried a piece of her mother's jewellery in her grandparents' garden there and was never able to find it afterwards because, well, she hadn't drawn a map. So all of us who read Treasure Island as children know that there always has to be a map. What we didn't know is that Robert Louis Stevenson based the map at the beginning of Treasure Island on the layout and landscape of Point Lobos opposite Monterey when he lived in California, or that he drew the map after he'd written the story, so he had to go back and check every footstep and natural feature for what they call continuity in the film industry. And we didn't know that he had the map drawn by his father's drawing office with all those respectable and diligent Scottish lighthouse engineers using their cartographer's knowledge and skills to illustrate a children's adventure for the chief engineer's son. Another couple of these little excerpts. Five. Dead Man's Chest. The quest, where there's a quest, there's a chart, is always to lay claim to Flint's buried Spanish gold. My Woodward sketchbooks have countless repeated X marks the spot, outlines in red, with their own complex system of grids, secret espionage codes in alternating lower and upper case, all finely traced out in reverse. I highlight the pitfalls, severed road bridges, an overshot pine forest, collapsed river banks. I establish positions, botanically exact symbols for previously unclassified species. Plan to head north by north-northwest. That's what the gazetteer advises. Oh, and I remember to pack a rucksack with tomatoes, dairy triangles, and buttered vita. But then I guess I find myself wondering in this next sequence, apart from finding the treasure, if maps always have the answer. Does making a map mean you can always find your way back? whenever the journey goes wrong. 6. Mapping the unmappable, in which maps are just one way of describing a voyage. Worlds are only part geography, part tales of love and detachment. Early years are both land and sea deep. Early is idyllic, high grasses and year-round sea clover in a cluster of brightly lit Christmas tree days at the year's end. The year I turn 11, my young father suffers a stroke. Though he quickly regains strength, he then watches my mother, suddenly fearful of an ebbing future and drawn to a distant place with no trail of white beach stones to lead her back. The year that, as a family, we step over the deep's pencil line, don't reach dry land for years, no charts to show us sea routes home, home to the known, the familiar. Stepping ashore just once would be a godsend. 7. Coming home late. But I can still set out late on that voyage home, back to that land or wherever, trace misfortunes, uncertainty, a family hiatus, year-long absences. I can blank out the controlling GPS voice, select every wrong turn if I so wish, guess at what's hidden in the worn sellotape folds. The territory will be coastlines, islands, the liminal, headlands that reach out to the far deep, down to the fathomed, unfathomable seafloor. You can see it's going to be a personal journey as well as an exploration of coastal travel life and coastal lives. And it's also in a sense about whether some things are actually impossible to map. Someone who had views on what could and couldn't be mapped was Herman Melville, someone I've always felt an affinity for because Moby Dick seemed to be such a challenge for a writer to write, such a whale of a book, maybe. One of the first things I did when I started spending each spring in the USA was to meet up with a long-lost cousin whose grandmother, my grandmother's sister, was that great-aunt, Rose McNeil, who had taken the voyage out 100 years before on a ship out of Belfast Harbour. And I found out that the cousin, Mary Ellen, who lives in Lansingborough, way up the Hudson River from New York, actually lives in Herman Melville's house. So this is the last of these short excerpts. 10. Lansingborough, New York State. Moby Dick is an early mobile library favourite. Friday afternoons, Bridge Street, cushioned all. Years later, my cousin will live in the Melville house, far from that grey library van, and we will stand in Herman's bedroom watching the broad, gushy Hudson in snow and slush rush its own long-mapped route down to wide and treacherous ocean charts. We might even wonder what that Ishmaelite meant by, "It is not down on any map, true places never are." Those are the true places I will hope to find a map to prove him wrong, that voyager out of Nantucket. Maybe, just maybe, the true places can be mapped, even the very deep ones. Maybe even, maybe like Elizabeth Bishop telling me I have to experience islands, maybe Herman Melville is challenging me to map the true places of the heart and the deeper meanings of sea and shore, of safety and the deeps. In the same way that Joseph Conrad's seafaring novels aren't just about the maritime journeys and the physical challenges, they're about the psychological implications of the strangeness and vastness and aloneness. Just as Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Ancient Mariner isn't really about the old sailor's superstition about the albatross, but is actually exploring how that vastness and being at the sea's mercy can finally set the mind adrift from its moorings. I travelled just now in that first chapter from our rainy guest house family summer in Port New in Donegal to the whalers setting out from North American harbours and islands into the wilds of the North Atlantic in pursuit of Moby Dick. And no, I didn't actually get to whale watch as part of the recent trip. The advice I got from the skipper of an old whale watching boat in Nantucket on a day when it was stormy and foggy and visibility zero was that he wouldn't have any problem getting me a place on a whale watching trip that day, as no one else would want to go out, as there wouldn't be anything to see. But of course the strong pull of the sea is there, not just for people who live and work by the sea, but for all those who live inland and who head for the sea on Sunday afternoons or head off to their summer houses each year. I know that coastal life, as in Antrim coast towns and New England harbour villages, and I'm sure here in County Cork, is always a mix of those who make their lives and homes there and those who come and go for love of the sea. And I've been fortunate to have been awarded several writing residencies in coastal places on England's east coast, under Achill and Inishman, and one recently in Carmel in California, where I could walk out onto Robert Louis Stevenson's Point Lobos every day. If you know the scenery from the Clint Eastwood movie, Play Misty for Me, you can guess how breathtaking that was, all the way down to Big Sur. And in another of those writers' residences where I spent an autumn month in Aldborough, I was living in a summer family's no longer used summer house, just yards from the sea. And I have to admit that I loved the sense of that house having once been alive in holiday times when the children were young. It reminded me very much of Irish novelist John Banville's great book, The Sea, filmed with Ciarán Hinds in the lead role. In the Banville story, Ciarán Hinds plays a widower who comes back to the seaside place where he was happy as a boy. And interestingly, Ciarán Hinds himself spent his own childhood summers in Cushendall, in my hometown. So you can imagine there was probably plenty of nostalgia for him in that role. Here's a little flavour of the opening chapter from John Banville's book. So much of life was stillness then, when we were young, or so it seems now. Abiding stillness, a vigilance. At the bottom of the hill I stopped and stood and looked three ways. Along Strand Road and back up Station Road and the other way towards a tin cinema and the public tennis courts. No one. It was said there was a church submerged in the sandy seabed down there, intact, with bell tower and bell, that once had stood on a headland that was gone too, brought toppling into the roiling waves one immemorial night of tempest and awful flood. The sign over the Strand Cafe advertising cigarettes, navy cut with a picture of a bearded sailor inside a lifebuoy, or a ring of rope, was it, creaked in the sea breeze on its salt-rusted hinges. Now that description, that nostalgia, that stillness of the past could so be Cushendall for me, or Achill Island, or Portneuf in Donegal, or it could be Aldborough, where I spent that autumn some years ago, or anywhere that takes me back to that house right down by the rocks, with the sea on three sides, the house I was born in, and maybe I haven't yet recovered from the closeness of those waves. Maybe we don't ever recover. As I said, I've been thinking about Elizabeth Bishop, not as a Bostonian city type, but as someone growing up just yards from the sea at the mouth of the great village and river, and how for the rest of her life, after she was taken away from that coastal place, she just had to get back to it every summer, and how as an adult she had to live by the bay somewhere, whether it was Boston Bay or Rio de Janeiro Bay. Bishop actually seems to me to be rather like the sandpiper in her sandpiper poem, obsessed with feeling the millions of grains of sand around the world, feeling them slipping with the ebb of a wave between her toes. And even when she found a summer place in Maine in her later years, it had to be on an island which you can only reach by ferry. Remember how, in that extract, Bishop encouraged us to find our island spirit, but then her neighbours were mostly descended from Scottish islanders. So her summer place on North Haven Island in Maine, which I took a ferry to a couple of months ago, is a wooden house with a veranda, just like her grandparents' house in Great Village. And just across the grass and through the trees, there's a small beach, just like the one behind the Great Village house. What I also discovered on Cape Breton Island was, of course, that it was full of Irish and Scottish music and a live tradition of writing new traditional tunes, some of them written by a fiddle player and former lighthouse keeper, Paul Cranford, whom we more or less wrote, met by accident, in that he and his wife Sarah, who's also a fiddler, have a handmade pottery business on Nova Scotia's Cabot Trail near Breton Cove. Cahill is going to, we're almost finished here, read a piece called Stella's Courage, and has, I like to think, some of the lightkeeper's tone of quiet reflection. Like all those poets who grew up by the sea, some of my sea journeys are maybe imaginary, maybe metaphorical, maybe fateful or final. And I'm going to end with a short poem. Going back, it's from my first collection, in fact, going back to that exaltation of Emily Dickinson's and the idea of taking to the sea and wondering whether the journey is real and what the final destination might be, or whether there's anything at the end of the journey. No far shore. It will be winter when I untie the boat for the last time, when I double lock the back door on an empty house, go barefoot through bramble and briar, measure each stone step to the slipway. It will be night time when I row to the horizon, steady in north starlight, the darkened house at my back. It will be winter when I draw each oar from the water, shiver and bite the cold from my lips.